Hello and welcome to Disrupting the Degree, the education marketing podcast. I'm Stephen Cleary from Carnival Content with
Zeynep Fayez
and Zeynep Fayez from The Brand Education. This podcast is all about higher education with industry trends, experts and practical ideas across the student experience, brand and marketing.
In this episode of Disrupting the Degree, we're joined by Felicity Gasparo, owner of Oyster Outcomes and associate consultant for SUMS. We'll be discussing her research into the well-being and mental health of academics and staff during COVID.
So Felicity, thank you for joining us, first of all. Can you just give us a little bit of an overview of your career so far?
Thank you very much for inviting me along. I initially started my career in 1993, back in Waitrose in Cobham, where I started as a weekend assistant. And I did that whilst I was doing all of my studies, right up until including my degree at Royal Holloway. When I left, I became a retail management trainee, a graduate trainee at Waitrose, and I held a number of different roles across Waitrose, John Lewis and Group. My last role with them finished in 2017 and was head of democratic engagement. And that role was really all about drawing across a number of channels to allow employee voice to surface and to hopefully challenge and give rigor and vigor to leadership decision making. When I left the John Lewis Partnership Group, I took a little bit of time out to support my husband in establishing his IFA practice, and then returned to work in a completely different sector, landing as head of marketing operations at the University of Reading. I then took an opportunity to set up Oyster Outcomes, which is my own business, which I'm working in now, in April 2019, and have been doing work under that banner ever since. In this capacity, I've also been doing some detailed work for an organisation called SUMS Consulting, and they are a higher education not-for-profit consortium. They have a small core team of staff and then have a range of other higher education experts on who they can draw skills and expertise. And it's with those guys that I've been doing this particular piece of work.
So what was the original purpose behind your research with SUMS, and did you adapt it when the pandemic started?
Yeah, so actually this piece of work started during the pandemic. So I'd been fortunate enough to be invited along as an associate consultant to take part in the SUMS Change Community Practice Group. And they were meeting, by the time the pandemic really got underway, they were meeting on a monthly basis. And what I was hearing from the change leaders of that cohort were really a number of brilliant initiatives from across universities to support their staff health and well-being. And but it seemed a little bit different from perhaps some of the conversations I was having with maybe directly with the members and some of the clients that I was working with on other projects. And so I was interested to see what was actually landing and what the staff of the universities were seeing and experiencing, and trying to knit the two together. So kind of came up with a piece of work where we looked at three themes around staff health, general well-being and remote working enablement. And we did a study where we looked at the pre, during and post lockdown survey attitude of staff. And we also had some more detailed conversations. And yes, it enabled us to get a really good handle on where the efforts, if you like, of the people in the positions of power or influence were landing out with the people who were affected. So we had 13 different institutions take part in the survey. And although we had 77 participants, we put that down to staff survey fatigue, because lots of universities were doing lots of work in the survey space around this area. But we were happy with that balanced against the other conversations that we had also been having.
What were the findings then about general well-being during each stage?
So we structured the questionnaire around eight different factors, and I sort of identified and again took from the Change CPG, crystallised eight key factors. And they were adapting to working from home, line manager contact, institutional communication, team connectivity, provision of home working kit to enable staff to carry out their roles, the institution provision of tools and resources to enable staff to stay well during COVID, the provision of a confidential route for staff to access if they did not feel well during COVID, and the training and skills provision to enable successful home working. And so we really identified that those were the eight key factors that we wanted to test out. And so we did. It was very interesting. So we ran a mixture of sort of qualitative and quantitative data through the survey. So when we started to look at the difference between how staff had perceived their institution's ability to look after their staff health prior to COVID even being a known thing to the end of July 2020, we found that 54.2% of staff were now saying their university was either slightly or extremely capable of doing this. And this was a 28% improvement. Mm, wow. So real feather in those universities' caps of showing that positive movement. But we also noticed that that same time period, general well-being held a steady state. And on the surface, I could see how some of the people that I had been working with in the Change Community Practice group could be disappointed with that because of all the efforts that they were going to really sort of, you know, create a general sense of well-being, albeit remotely for their staff. But actually, when you think about the circumstances that people were finding themselves in, and, you know,
it's impressive, actually, yeah, to keep it consistent through that period.
Exactly right. It was a good thing. And now hopefully they can continue to sort of push on and improve that score further. So, yeah.
Was there anything else that surprised you from the results?
As I went through the work, and I literally took it section by section, I had anticipated that by the time people completed their survey, so by the time they'd answered all the questions, that things like the setup of home kit had been taken care of and that people would be, you know, fully working from home and that would all be good. But actually, there was still some dissatisfaction in that area and some opportunity to improve. And particularly, I think, when you come to looking at some of the more specific tools that maybe academic staff may have needed to enable them to teach and deliver a decent teaching experience, I think that was a little bit of a surprise. I would have thought that would have been more nailed. Having said that, to sort of flip it over throughout the survey, you know, people couldn't be more positive really about the role of IT and the work that IT had done sort of heroically to turn overnight really the learning experience from an in-person to an online experience overnight. So that was really positive.
So do you think universities still need a little bit more support with remote working then?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think there are a number of different things that they can look to do to help improve the experience of their staff who are working from home. And they do broadly land underneath those eight key factors. And they range from things like, you know, we're all humans with varying degrees of need for human connectivity. But even if this is just driven out of a sense of, I need to work with these people because it's going to pay the mortgage, and not necessarily a sense of wanting to belong to a group, versus I need to collaborate in a very intense way with this individual because we're doing this really important piece of research work, versus actually I'm part of a highly creative marketing team and we're all about collaboration and working together. That sense of human connectivity is really important. And so whatever universities can do to enable that is really important. Another thing that stood out from our research was initially there was sort of the feedback. Nearly 25% of respondents said they didn't have regular contact with their line manager during lockdown. And we cannot emphasize enough, really, I can't emphasize enough. And line managers out there will know, and businesses know it, organizations know it, universities know it. The role of the line manager is absolutely instrumental. Yeah. I would take it a step further. So again, bearing in mind that the context of this work was set out in the Change CPG, I would say what we need to do is make sure that the middle managers in the university who are the translators of key messages, channeling, you know, upwards and downwards, if you like, through the university hierarchy, that they are actually sort of enabled to become those agents of change. Because if you do that, if you're absolutely able to embed those principles of continuous improvement and agile working and great communication skills and all of those kind of key component parts, then it means that the next thing that happens, you've already got people there who are ready to just run with the ball. And I think that was one of the things that perhaps wasn't present. So we had an example of a university, again, in the commentary of the survey, one university, and this was commented on several times, had announced unilaterally, I think, that the professional service staff would not be returning to campus until January 21. But that decision had been kept completely at the chests of the UEB. And you can understand that. But at the same time, even the heads of department hadn't been kept in the loop and didn't have a set of FAQs that they could use to support their staff in answering.
This is something we talked about in the first episode of this podcast, actually, about transparency and especially during a time like the pandemic, even if you're a line manager, you're still going through these issues as well. If from top down, you can be transparent and let people know what's going on, it definitely helps, doesn't it?
It's incredibly important to have the open dialogue, even if it's through emails or one-to-ones via Skype.
Excuse my ignorance, Felicity, but what's the Change CPG?
Oh, Change Community Practice Group. So they're a group of, so SUMS is a member organisation. They have, I think, around 26 universities who are members of their consortium. And they invite change leaders from their membership to join this group, which meets currently monthly. And they're basically looking at all the key trends in higher education, in change management, and how to get, they share best practice. They talk about how to move the, move things on. So that's what the Change CBG is.
Okay, bro.
Do you have any examples of where there has been an excellent support of their staff mental health and wellbeing?
An initiative that was put in place by one university prior to COVID was the implementation of a number of mental health first aiders. And we saw this across a number of the universities that we spoke to. So they had, whether it was called a mental health first aider or a wellbeing champion or a wellbeing advisor, you know, might be called a number of different things, but this individual had received specific skills and experience to be able to intervene early. So the premise, if you look at Mental Health First Aid England's website, then you'll very quickly get to see the premise of mental health first aid. I don't know if you're familiar with that as a term, but is that you get in there early. So it might just be, hey, Zina, how are you doing today? And in the flicker of an eye, I'm recognizing that you're not okay. And I stop off then and say, do you want to grab a coffee? And then we might have a chat. And then we might identify that actually you're really anxious about something. And then as a first aider, I might be able to signpost some things that help you, or actually just in the process of us sitting down and having that conversation, you might have been able to get it off your chest, put it to bed and move on with your day. So what we noticed was that one of the universities had already, prior to COVID, trained 150 of its staff body in mental health first aid. But when we look at the size of universities and the number of people they employ, if you also look at what Mental Health First Aid England's aspiration is to have 1 in 10 of the population trained in mental health first aid, there's a long way for universities to go in terms of achieving that, realising that.
And I really like that, actually, because not everybody would ask for help. So if it's recognised and it's over a quick coffee, that almost sounds quite informal, but very important.
Yeah, absolutely. This type of initiative in the past could have been something perhaps that was passed on to somebody who was perceived to have the time to do it. But actually, I would argue that we don't have the time not to do it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Absolutely.
So if I look at Mental Health First Aid England highlighting that 70 million days of sick leave were lost last year through mental health issues. That's a substantial amount. And mental health, mental poor health has overtaken the bad back as the key reason.
I think you're pretty much answering our next question there, which is... It seems that some universities are looking at cost cutting during this uncertain time. What are the business advantages of focusing on student and staff well-being rather than cutting costs?
Yeah. So if I rewind all the way back to where I began my history, where I began my employment working for the John Lewis Partnership, I'm really familiar with and working for an organisation that knew that the happiness and well-being of its staff, or as John Lewis will say, their partners, is in terms of productivity, efficiency. And so, you know, right throughout their organisation, they have these core principles which sort of link them to that. And they do that for a reason. You know, time, you know, Speed and Lewis didn't do it because he was just being a kindly gentleman who wanted to help people. And there may have been, a large degree of philanthropy, but he actually knew there was a hard commercial benefit to doing it. And so it's really interesting here because we know as higher education professionals that the strain that universities, or many universities, not all, but many universities are under at the moment is immense. We've just seen out the recruitment cycle for 2020. We know even prior to COVID that a number of institutions were really being called out on their financial conduct and sustainability. We know that there are plans afoot from a government point of view to make some quite big changes around higher education provision and all sorts of different things. So this is like the perfect storm, and then COVID lands on top of it. So you can forgive universities or any organisation at the moment to be wanting to pull some very hard levers. And if you like, say, right, well, we just need to shut down that function because it's not delivering, let's stop it. Or that school's not delivering, let's stop it. And maybe some of those decisions need to be made. But if you can get your workforce working well and productive for you, isn't that better? You know, so by really making sure that people are working well is important, and that was really the thrust of this report.
My concern is that I worked 10 years in house in higher education, but to go through the pandemic and especially from my colleagues in marketing, working so hard to keep everything going, to then be hit with the uncertainty and worrying of restructures or worse, it's the absolute opposite effect of what should be happening with encouraging productivity and, so what are we going to do for next year during this time? Like what are the opportunities here rather than let's cut costs?
Yeah. It takes a toll, doesn't it? Like the whole 6 months have been incredibly difficult, and then you've got to worry whether you're going to have a job at the end of it. So it's must be so stressful.
And there was a degree of commentary about that as we came towards the end of our survey. People were really calling out, you know, what does the autumn look like? We still don't know. So lack of senior leader decision making was highlighted as being a factor, something that people needed to hear from. Interestingly, when we looked at communication in detail, the groundswell of opinion was that people really wanted to hear from their VC or their president. They wanted to hear from the top person of the institution about what was going on, and they wanted to hear it regularly, and they wanted to hear it in a timely way. They also wanted their line managers to be informed, but it was most important that universities found a way of being honest and transparent and fair to them. There's no doubt it's a stressful time potentially. And at a time when typically in recessions, you might see a contraction of functions such as organizational development, learning and development. Perhaps occupational health could go from maybe 2 to 1, you know, you might see some of those core people functions being reduced. Actually, we're probably saying you need to double and redouble those resources, and you need to somehow find the resources from elsewhere, because they will pay back.
But as you said, the downside of burnout and long-term sick from this, it could be huge, couldn't it, if the staff aren't looked after?
Yeah. I mean, many universities as public sector employers are very generous in terms of their, you know, sick cover provision. You know, so if you have a team of people, you know, a cohort of people that go off sick and long-term sick because of their mental health, then you're really going to be stuck in a difficult position. So what we really want is early intervention. We want to get as many universities on the front foot as possible with this and trying to be in there and supporting their people. That does not mean being untruthful. If something needs to be said, if a function is closing, if the school is is not continuing with some of its courses, then those messages need to be put out there.
But yes.
You know, at the end of the day, I think, we really do need the executive boards to be absolutely leaning into this as a challenge and doing all they can do to try to keep their staff at work. The other thing, just whilst it strikes my crosses my mind, is as well as people actually being off sick, you've also got a potentially high proportion of people being at work but not at work. So their body's there, but their mind is not. And Mental Health First Aid England would call that would describe that as presenteeism. So, and in a remote working context, how do you pick that up?
Oh, yeah.
So how do you pick up that someone's not actually there?
Yeah.
So, you know, again, even worse, really, that you've got a workforce who are out there in the ether who you're not maybe connecting with because you haven't prioritized line manager conversations. You're having to trust them, but you may not want to be trusting them. And they're just turning up, they're turning on their computer, and they're just not being able to be very productive because they're really not very well.
And because you're not there, you can't see those nuances of their change in behavior. It must be really challenging as a line manager to pick that up.
If you flip that, then there are people that are working from home, but that, you know, you mentioned that they are now living at work. How do line managers notice that? You know, that they're going out of their way to really help, but no one's noticing that, are they?
Yeah. So again, it's really interesting. In preparation for this this podcast, I had a quick chat with one of my former colleagues from the John Lewis Partnership. She was an occupational health advisor, Jeanette Pratt, lady called Jeanette Pratt, who I'd worked with in Waitrose. And we were sort of shooting the breeze around some of this and what were the most effective things that we could do. Well, actually, some of the most effective things that people could be doing around noticing this is just making sure that there's a clear demarcation around working hours. That, you know, we all say it, but how many of us actually do it? The emails really aren't done after hours or certainly aren't expected to be responded to. One of our participants in our survey suggested having an every other week no email day. So you literally don't respond to emails on a day every other week. But in conversation with Jeanette, some of the other things that she said, which were very often overlooked and were borne out as having been overlooked through the responses in this survey, were that people just hadn't identified or associated with well-being things like getting a good night's sleep, making sure you keep check on your alcohol intake, obviously, excluding drug intake, caffeine intakes, staying hydrated, fresh air walks, making sure that you're not in back-to-back Zoom meetings. You know, so some of those really good principles around just general well-being. You know, a lot of what I was reading was about, you know, and this is not me dismissing these at all, because these are also very valid for groups of people. But, you know, yoga sessions or meditation or faith and well-being sessions or music. I mean, you can't sing together at the moment. I learned from my children's school, they're not good. They can't sing together at the moment because of the virus, because of the, you know, but what's to say you can't have an online choir? So those are all very valid suggestions, but the very basics of what we need as human beings, we know that these are things that really help us when we're stressed out. So, you know.
I love the idea of not looking at emails for a full day.
Yeah.
I just realised, Felicity, that I was messaging you at 9 o'clock last night, so sorry about that.
I don't think I replied. Did I reply? I might have.
Yeah. Yes, you did.
An entrepreneur, she takes calls only once every one day a week to increase her productivity, which I found really interesting. But yeah, I think just having a good schedule and a well-being plan for yourself.
A healthy one, yeah, I think.
A self-development, a health and well-being plan. Mm.
Sorry, I was just going to finish off on one last point, is to say, of course, universities and institutions can do so much. But the other thing is a cultural piece, in that people also need to lean in themselves and take responsibility for their own health and well-being. And of course, if you're unwell, that can be quite difficult to do. It can be very difficult to do, and you do need people to be watching your backs and looking out for you and sort of flagging with you if they think you're not doing too well. But culturally, this is perhaps a bit of a tipping point for universities, maybe from that maybe this sort of unionized parent child stepping into a really much more adult conversation between its sort of staff and senior leaders. And I think we could be starting to see much more of that come through. And I know that's a gross generalization, because different universities will be at very different ends of the spectrum on that point.
Yeah.
But culturally, I think this is as much about that as it is about some of the things that can be done.
Yeah. So what sort of advice would you give our listeners to improve their well-being?
So I think it depends who the listener is. I think if we're talking about individual well-being, I would start, I think your idea about having your own well-being plan is really important. We know that when people have been working, and I do think generally of people working in education, this is true. A lot of members of staff have been working at high levels of stress, and that whole cortisol has been riding high for a long period of time. What we need to try to do is build in a bit more of self-nurture. Now, just by me saying those two words will have probably switched off at least half of the audience. So I apologize for that. Some of the respondents in the survey were talking about things like, nobody has spoken to me to ask me if I am okay. Nobody.
That's so sad.
That's really sad. I'm pretty sure I ask everyone, oh, how are you? Or about it's hard though, isn't it?
I think they might have been looking up towards sort of their line manager or their boss's boss sort of thing, maybe not a colleague, but it was just, you know, I haven't been asked if I'm okay. Or actually saying thank you goes a long way. Yeah. Recognising what we're doing and what we're going through.
And showing some appreciation, I think, is quite important as well.
Yeah, I think so. And I think recognising, being honest and saying, we don't know what the next week holds at the moment. It's not about being patronising or trying to do it in an unnatural way. You've got to pitch it right for the right individual.
And it has to be genuine as well.
Yeah, genuine.
Right, well, thank you so much, Felicity. It's been a fascinating chat and such an important topic.
Thank you so much, Felicity.
You're really welcome. Thanks for the opportunity to come on and have a chat.
In next week's episode, we'll be discussing virtual open days, clearing 2020 and COVID on campus with Rebecca Lever, Associate Director of Marketing and UK Student Recruitment at Swansea University. If you like what you're hearing, it would mean a lot to us if you'd subscribe. Disrupting the Degree is brought to you by The Brand Education and Carnival Content.